Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. You're so big, nobody. I can't see anybody behind you. What can I do about that? I could sit higher than you. No. I'll just have to imagine you're all there. We can't, because he's Otto in disguise, you see, so we can't move him. We could trade places with her, and you could just take the tape thing back there with you. And where it goes click, you'll hear it or something. How's that?
That's fine.
She wants her bottom. Do you want your bottom cushion, or is that okay?
No, this is fine.
Good. Oh, what a neat little footstool he sitteth upon it.
I can't sit cross-legged, so...
Yeah, neither can I.
Found a solution.
So, do you have any questions, answers, comments, or complaints about last night? That was good, was it? So I really don't need to do another class tonight then, do I? Oops.
Yes. Not specifically to what we talked about, but kind of indirectly.
Surely.
How did the split happen? Like this disagreement between the Theravada and Mahayana.
It's
and
not a disagreement. The basic teaching is the same, Wayne.
No, but there's...
They're different way of proceeding.
But aren't there some Theravadins who kind of reject and say that?
Oh yeah, and Mahayanas. I was talking to a teacher in Toronto who will be nameless. He just happens to be the head of the Kagyu Center in Toronto, but we won't name who he is or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, I'm going to go and do a retreat. I have like 10 days, and I'm going to go do a retreat. I'm really happy. He said, oh, that's right. Excellent. Where are you going? And I named this teacher that I was going to go and do some meditation with, and he went, oh, Theravadin. You know. Do you understand? Sectarianism exists everywhere.
Yeah.
Always, everywhere. Sectarianism exists. But in terms of the true teaching of Dharma, Dharma is Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
People's beliefs are what they're able to hear of Dharma and how they're able to work with it to the best of their ability. So it's very important to listen to people and to see whether they are teaching something that you need to learn. I have had teachers that were, for me, excellent teachers. After I learned from them, I had no need to continue to study with them, I thought, certainly, and I still think. They are not people that I would suggest anyone else study with. But for me, at that time, it was perfect. And I'm very grateful. One of my teachers was really excellent in teaching jhana to a woman in Thailand. And she was very interested in having me maintain my connection with her because she was looking for someone to be her successor. And they, you know, they like Westerners who are sincere in Thailand, you know. So I seemed like I had all the bells and whistles that made me look good in the dark, you know. And she was an excellent teacher. And she also, along with many other teachers, told me that this was the only true teaching. There is a Tibetan saying that for every student, a new teaching arises. I think that's more true than the idea that many people in the West have, that there is one teacher that is your, quote, guru. But in the West, we're very fond of possessions. And we tend to think of things in terms of mine. The self is not that trustworthy. I would not necessarily be so convinced, if I were you, that every guru that you feel is your guru is really your guru. It could be someone that your neuroses fit really well and yourself feels comfortable. But maybe that's what you have to learn from them. You know? So the real teacher is in your own heart. So when the real teacher is in your own heart, and all beings have bodhicitta, however latent it may be, then that is what has to mature and grow. That sacred part of mind. That is what has to mature and grow. And it matures and grows two ways, through love and through suffering. Right? Eventually, we all learn a little bit of candy and a little bit of a whip, you know? Eventually, we all learn, don't we? So, in the process of learning, it's interesting to note that there are 10. What do they call them? I've forgotten the Pali word. Bhojangas, is it? No, the bhojangas are the factors of awakening. They're fetters. 10 fetters that have to be cleared. The fetters. The fetters of consciousness. Like the cages I was talking. Mm-hmm. I was saying last night that I have a friend who works in the Calgary Zoo. And I was talking to him about the zoo and how, although I'm not fond of zoos, I really enjoy the Calgary Zoo, but it does disturb me to see the bears pacing, etc., etc., you know? And he was saying, yeah, I know what you're saying, but he said, you know, all animals live in cages. You have the cage, if you're a bear, of the bear 20 miles away who's stronger, or the cage of your food supply, or, and it's true, all animals live in cages. And the cage is called the self. Self is a felt sense based mostly on emotional need. Mostly. And that's our cage. And we're afraid to go out of it. Because we identify so strongly with those bars that we don't know that consciousness is on both sides of the cage quite happily. We get caught in the captivity while there is that part of ourselves that can never be captive and knows what freedom is. So any dialogue you have with a teaching, you will always be going back and forth between the cage and the beyond cage. Mm-hmm. Always. You'll have flashes of insight and then you'll find yourself right back in square one again. Isn't that true? Because you have to know both. You have to know the compassionate reason for the cage. You have to understand cause and effect. See, liberation is not just about liberation, it's also the awareness of cause and effect. The one absolutely trustworthy thing that you should really start to pay attention to is cause and effect. It is the most profound dharma. Nothing arises without cause. Whatever is caused is supported by conditions. Right? Whatever is given birth to arises because the conditions are right. Is that true? Whatever is conditioned is not permanent. Isn't this really profound if you look at it? Whatever is arising is impermanent. How come the same patterns keep occurring? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Due to ignorance, says Buddhism. Due to ignorance. How do you get out of ignorance? Sometimes by banging your head against the cage walls enough times so that you actually stop 1/4 of a millisecond before you hit and say, wait a minute, there's something familiar about what I'm doing now. And sometimes because you really want to know and you open your eyes and you look at the cage. Does this make sense to you? So these 10 fetters, one of the first ones to fall when you experience what they call stream entry, which means you enter the streaming of consciousness rather than try to barricade yourself in a cage, is the belief in a permanent self. It's one of the first to fall. You know what one of the last ones to fall is? Conceit. Go figure. If there is no belief in an inherent self, how can there be conceit? Go figure. How? Because then there is conceit about the cause and effect that opened to the stream. The conceit is because that person who is easily an arahat, you know, one step below arahat, easily a stream enterer, easily an arahat, one step below arahat, with a vast, vast mind, vast understanding, but still is more aware of the cause and effect of that streaming continuum, and so has a tendency to think that that's the right way. These teachers were very great. But there is that conceit, you know? Do you understand that? Isn't that interesting?
Would they have a sense of completion while there's more to go on?
Sorry?
Would they have a sense of it was completed now and there was more to go on?
Well, it isn't necessarily so that they would have a sense of completion. They would have a really strong understanding of the complete, of peacefulness. But the view of, you know, the basis of how it isn't universal is still within the streaming. So, for example, the Buddha, when he was still alive, one of the things he used to do was take a bunch of his well-attained disciples off into the boonies and get them to meditate on past lives, to open the stream, to open the understanding, to get beyond just one cause and effect, you know, just one, this is the path, this is the way. And I love that saying by the Tibetans, for every student there is a new teaching. That's very beautiful.
There's another one saying that there are no superior teachings or equal teachings or inferior teachings, there are just appropriate teachings.
That's lovely. That's lovely. And your own inner teacher knows when something is appropriate or when it isn't. Someone can be giving you a very appropriate teaching and you may not like it, but you can feel the rightness. Is that true? Someone can give you very inappropriate teaching and you may like it, But you can feel the dullness. Is that true? I haven't really answered you, have I? Is that?
Well, it's sufficient for now.
Is that sufficient?
Yep.
Okay. If you have a sense of that part of yourself that knows what is real, and you find yourself also sabotaging that from occurring, do you understand what I'm saying? If you have a sense of hearing truth, but you keep writing, but not for me, I'm too busy, I got it.
Okay, gotcha.
Then what you probably need to do is you need to do a lot of Vajrasattva work. Because that disbelief or lack of confidence in your own being is based on the seeds of past experiences ripening. If you can hear what there is to do, but you find that circumstances continuously make it impossible, or this happens, or that happens, or, you know, your life is basically out of control, although you feel like you're just barely keeping your head above it, riding the wave, you know that you're not doing what you want to do, and you know, I can't believe this is happening, I just finished paying off the mortgage, is a real life, life story for you. Do Vajrasattva work. Vajrasattva removes obscurations, softens the mind, opens to the joy of truth. Vajrasattva gives you a holiday. You don't have to try so hard. It washes away the result of past activity. In the Theravadin tradition, you have the four efforts. First effort, when the unwholesome arises, cut it off. Second effort, when you see the possibility of the unwholesome arising, don't enter. Third effort, when the wholesome arises, name it. Name it. Make it more conscious. Make it something you consciously aspire to while it is happening. Have motive for it to occur. That's very powerful. And the fourth, when you see the possibility of wholesomeness, enter it. Those are the four efforts. They're wonderful. In terms of energy, they will create the balance of energy that is the golden wheel. Those four efforts. In the Mahayana tradition, you talk about the four vows, which are basically the same teaching. The first vow is called repent, usually. That means when you see an unwholesome thought or action or speech arising, immediately know it's happening. Don't just ignore it. Repent. You know? So, wait. What was that I just did? That's powerful, isn't it? Now imagine yourself driving a car. Talk about body, speech, mind, unwholesome actions. Eh? Imagine somebody comes up behind you and they're tailgating you. Even though the lane is empty beside you. What do you do? Do you slow down a bit? What do you do? Whatever you do. Imagine your mind. What does your mind do? Wholesome? Unwholesome? Imagine that they find...
What?
I'm Christian.
Imagine they suddenly pull out really close to you and whip by you with a roar, and then they pull in really in front, right in front of you, like just about cut you off. What is your mind state? Anybody in this room who drives like to tell me that they have not experienced that? And is the mind wholesome or unwholesome? Is it?
Unwholesome.
And do you know how many moments that are not quite that dramatic, but during the day, how many moments of those little unwholesome thoughts or speech or activity when you just ignore someone because you don't want to hear them? And can you imagine if you actually started taking that seriously, because that's your training, that's what the causes that you are planting, and the effects will come. If you actually took that seriously and really thought, maybe I don't want these seeds to ripen. Just, you know, just an outside chance that maybe might be nice to be born in some other orchard. Other than bitter fruit. So that's the first vow. Repent. That means be aware of those 1,001 little moments where you act not in accordance with who you really would like to be. Where you give yourself away too cheaply. Just because somebody else who you've never met, you'll never see again. You don't know when his or her hormone level will balance out and they won't ever do that again. You know? You don't know what their problem is. And meanwhile, they're just going along doing what, and look at what it's done to your whole balance. Right? I mean, who are they to you? Anything? No. Which in itself is a problem, but we won't get into that tonight. Really? Do you understand that? That's very interesting, isn't it? That sense of what's right or wrong, as if it was your road.
My road.
Or sometimes you sort of just speed up a little as they're passing you, right? Just why? Why? Those are the seeds you're planting. Isn't that interesting? You really take that repent one and really just explore it. Don't use it to beat yourself. But just explore it. Explore how many times during the day you're the king or queen of the universe and passing the laws. Yeah. How everybody should be and why you're right and they're wrong. Or they're right, but you're going to be... You're going to give it to them anyway, you know. All that stuff, you know. That's your cage. And every one of those actions makes sure the bars will come for a few more beats. They're strong because they're habitual actions, and it's the habitual actions that have the strongest power of death, rebirth. It's all very well and good to sit cross-legged and move your energy up and have yab-yummers and big great blisses, but when you die, and the habits are strong. So consider it, you know? Consider it. It's worth consideration. You can just take one thing, like when you're going shopping or when you're doing dishes or when you're, you know? One action when you're eating or when you're driving a car, and just watch for repent. Watch just one action for a while. And watch and try to teach your mind how not to get caught in those unwholesome states. Because they happen so quickly and we ignore most of them. Don't you think so? Mm-hmm. We just write them off. But they're not written off. They are actions and their effects will arise. It's like they're trailing behind. So that's the first one. I was writing this out for myself because I noticed that I hadn't been working with these, and so I have for the first stage of repenting, no longer neglect, but rather pay attention to arising seeds of greed, hatred, and delusion. Pay attention to them. Note them. Feel them without squirming away, because that's what I do. I squirm away from them. I'm sure none of you do that. Oh, well, they shouldn't have been speeding anyway, you know. Experience the discomfort of that mind state that causes those actions. Because it's uncomfortable. Greed, hatred, and delusion are the motives there. And it's uncomfortable if you actually pay attention to it. Don't use the outer object for your justification. Realize that that's yours. You're the one who's making it. It's your cage. And the second one is called remorse. First one is repent, second one is remorse. This is not guilt. This is a little bit of a wake-up call where you imagine all of the moments to now from the very no beginning of ignoring the unwholesome and the endless seeds of karma that are waiting to ripen. Okay. And you think, ah, oh, with all my heart, I wish that these actions had not been done. It's true, isn't it? I really do not want to perform these actions anymore. I really have remorse for how often I have ignored the unwholesome activity. I do not wish to perform these actions anymore. You make that statement. I really do not want to do them because you really don't. Because they do bear fruit. It's very straightforward, isn't it? Very clear, very right there. It is. And then the third one is you make a vow. Now, it varies for me, the vow. If it's one that I know, it's just going to creep back real quick. I make the time limit. I do it at a time limit. I say, you can say, I never want to do this again. Please, Vajrasattva, help me not to do this. Or you can say, I don't want to do this for the next 5 minutes, which I very commonly say, because I have a better understanding of who I'm working with. I sort of look in the mirror, I say, yeah, 5 minutes. Let's not add more guilt to this one. Please, Vajrasattva, let me do that. You just have to take it in, you know, 1 minute increments. It's just this minute that you have to not do it. But you make a vow and you make it very clearly. For this moment, don't make it like grandiose. For all my future lifetimes, I will never tell a lie. Ah, oh, there's one right there. So as a time limit, you can use with the vow, use a time limit to give yourself power. Do you understand that? To give yourself power, that something you can actually do. And if you go beyond it, wonderful. And then the last one is to take refuge. Take refuge in the awakening. Take refuge in all the Buddhas and all those who have gone before. Take refuge. So that's the Vajrayana equivalent to the Theravadin, the four efforts. They're called the four vows in Vajrayana. And they're very much a part of the work of Vajrasattva. Because to now, from the very no beginning, when you think of all of the countless of life forms there have been innumerable actions motivated by greed, by hatred, and by delusion that have been performed with ignorance. And it doesn't matter whether there was ignorance or not, those seeds will ripen. And they will ripen when the circumstances are favorable. And one would wish that they not be favorable in this life. So that's what you're doing this for, to try to decrease the likelihood of becoming a favorable ground for the unwholesomeness to continue. Because you want to make effort for the teacher within your heart, the one who knows, to have a stronger voice. Is that interesting to you?
So Thomas Jefferson said, one of the big American heroes, I'm against every tyranny over the mind of man. And I had that feeling when I was young. I didn't realize the tyranny was my own mind.
Yes. Very often.
Okay. Somebody evolved the mind.
Yeah. The cage.
Yeah. Not somebody else's mind.
No. So once you have some kind of familiarity with the four vows or the four efforts, then you have enough intelligence to be able to pick out that they almost always arise conjoined with like, dislike, and indifference. When somebody's tailgating you, is it like, is it dislike, or is it indifference? It's not likely indifference, is it? For some people it is. It almost always arise, well, I would say always, but I'll let you explore it for yourself. They will arise conjoined with those three emotions. And those emotions can be very strong in the moment, and they are the result of past actions as well, propensities. So who is in charge? all these seeds ripening all the time. Who's in charge? How do you know what you really like or you really dislike? How do you know what you're not conditioned to like and dislike? Do you know whether you even might like dislike? Or dislike liking? What do you really know about those reactions? A lot of people hold on to their likes and dislikes as a way of making themselves safe, don't they? The island. Is it safe? I don't know. The last thing I remember was paying a mortgage on. Safe from what? What is there in this endless round of death and rebirth that somewhere in the continuum of your being has not already happened? What are you safe from? Huh? What are you trying to be safe from? There's no safety. It's already happened. You know? That horrible thing has already happened. It's over. Forget it. And look, you're still here. Whoever you may be, whatever circumstances may arise. So then what is really interesting is, what is mind? What is the continuum mind? What is mind outside of the cage of like and dislike? You cannot begin to explore that until you can explore like and dislike and neutrality or indifference. Can you? I don't think so. Do you think so?
Say that again.
You cannot begin to explore what non-conditioned mind is like, until you know what is not limited by like, dislike, and neutrality, and indifference. So it seems to me that one of the real things that you want to be on about is watching those three. A sound goes by and it attaches to the ear, and immediately there is an emotion attached to it. I like it, I dislike it, I'm just going to pretend it didn't happen. Isn't that true? Why? Because it's not I. It's not my cage. It might be your cage, but it's not my cage. My cage is more holy, or it eats ice cream every Tuesday, or, you know, whatever the rules are. And my cage is impermanent, it's subject to death, but the seeds of karma are not. Cause and effect continues, not a self. Now that's interesting. all of the time you refuse to enter something, does it go away? Becomes a major focus of your consciousness, actually. You know, when you really decide to dislike someone because you've broken up with them or something, and everywhere you go you're sure you see them. Right?
Or you think you're going to be there, so you put the place.
So you don't go, yeah. And et cetera, et cetera.
On and on and on.
Continuously.
Get in that trap.
We're all in that trap. Yeah. So who is it that untangles the tangle? The one who does not just respond. It's not just Pavlovian about the whole thing. Slavering at every bell that rings. And the one who actually tries to see what is like, what is dislike. What is indifference? What is it? You find yourself habitually saying, oh yeah, I don't like this, or oh, I like that. Immediately change it and say the opposite and watch what happens.
For me, it seems to have a lot to do with the state. If I allow myself to leave a calm state.
Calm is very important to it, isn't it?
And I won't have the energy you need to look at an event. If I can see a person, I like one of the Buddhist views of another person. You're meeting an event. It's not the same. It's an ongoing event. It's not what
it's a process.
Yesterday.
It's not an object.
Not what you saw yesterday.
That's right.
You know who you expect to get something from today.
No, yeah. And not who it is going to be tomorrow. Of course, none of those fantasies.
You've got chakras and suns and stars and just carrying the universe. What am I seeing?
Yeah.
But it takes, if I'm drowning in my own
cage,
I haven't got the energy.
Well, your energy is all, your interest is all in maintaining the cage.
It is, yeah. You're not free.
And there has to be a glimpse, allowing that part of yourself that knows beyond one life to have some voice.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't easy to have a precious human birth. A precious human birth isn't not just a human birth. Precious human birth is a birth where there is the circumstance to practice and the circumstance to hear a valid teaching.
A valid teaching.
Don't confuse me with details for you. That's your view.
Okay.
A valid teaching. A valid teaching is a valid teaching. And that's a precious human birth. And when you meet a precious human birth, it's very rare, and it might not even last in that lifetime. You might be interested for a while, and then you might go become a taxi driver or something. Who knows? Something else might be more satisfying to your sense of self. I mean, who wants to spend all their time repenting, regretting, making vows, and taking refuge, you know? Jeez, this is boring. I want to do some astral projection, eh? And you'll do some. So it's a really wonderful thing to have a precious human birth. Yes.
When you emphasize the word precious, I mean, I just want to sort of elaborate. Are you referring to the fact one who was born into the human realm who hears the teaching, as opposed to those who continue on in their kind of
land
of ignorance. And
here's the teaching. It has the ability to understand the teaching to some degree, has the ability to practice the teaching, right? Mm-hmm. Has the circumstances to have some understanding of that teaching come from the practice. Mm-hmm. That's a precious human birth.
Is it your view that at one, I mean, just as a question thrown out, that at any given time, any human being, it's supposedly in their journey of life, may at one time hear such a voice calling, and then
there is a dharma is everywhere.
Yeah.
Who is able to hear it depends on present supporting circumstances. Seeds of karma ripening. You want the seeds of karma to ripen quicker for you to be able to hear it? Do Vajrasattva.
Mm-hmm.
Practice the four
mm-hmm.
vows.
I see. As opposed to some child born in South America living on a garbage heap.
Who may not ever
have that opportunity.
Yeah, may be caught totally in trying to survive or die very young.
Yeah.
Born in a culture where a teaching is not. You know, the Yanomamo Indians, natives in the Amazon, whose whole culture is based on warfare.
Mm-hmm.
For a good time, that just sounds like a ball to me.
Sounds like the NHL.
It is, it's hockey,
in
right?
In a sense, that's the truth, that is. The NHL.
So, it's past experiences and cause and effect that have brought us to the teaching?
Yeah.
Is it a distraction to pursue why there is interest in the Dharma? Or, like, is that a sideline kind of thing?
I don't think that it has a lot of validity because for most people, that would be purely an intellectual exercise, and you could be applying your intellect into something more worthwhile, and life is fleeting. So it might be useful, but I don't know if you have the time. You know? What would be the purpose of that? You know? It might be wiser to practice regret. You know, to sort of stop the habits that are creating the less than precious birth, because they build for us those habits. Yes.
When I was reflecting on that some time ago, with the human, the precious human birth, part of me saying that because it is, I mean, you know, the difficulty in getting in, you know, the Dharma, and then practicing it, the opportunity, you know, the circumstances. But it almost seems that the whole universe is kind of cruel, isn't it? Because the opportunity and the chance, you know, you take all the circumstances.
No, because seeds of karma ripen. It is not people. You're thinking that there are people. You're thinking that there are permanent there are beings as objects. Like, this person is born in this circumstance.
Yeah.
But that's not true. Seeds of karma are ripening.
Okay.
So here you got this hose. Got this hose. And this water is coming through the hose.
Right.
The water is coming at a great force. And there's no nozzle on the hose, right? It's just an open-ended. And there's a lot of force. And when the water comes out, does it just drop?
No.
Why?
Because the force is pushing it out.
Yeah, it's going in a force in a particular way, and it follows the rules, the laws of cause and effect.
Right.
But at some time or other, it all starts to fall down, and it will create more or less a main puddle. Right?
Yeah.
But there are also some drops that will fall right away. Right? Your little hand gets wet when you hold it, because some drops... Right?
Yeah.
And some sort of spray out a bit along the way, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't all end up together. Right?
Right.
And then that puddle is there, and part of it is in the sunshine, and part of it is in the shade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the part that's in the sun evaporates faster.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the part that's in the shade sinks down into the water table.
Right.
So here you are. You're contained. The force of your life is contained by a hose, by a shape. Then the shape is going to end. And the force of all the cause and effect, the thousand and one little moments of motivation to be holy, motivation to be unholy, motivation to be up, motivation to be down, motivation to be in, motivation to be out, right? There are going to be running around all along in the same basic form. But some of them are going to start dropping off at different places. And we'll join the whole universal flux of cause and effect and find a table that is the right according to the propensities of where they fall and the power of how they were going. And be caught up in the ground, in the water under the ground, or be caught up in the clouds and move here and then reform somewhere else in some other thing. Will it be exactly the same water?
No.
Will it be according to cause and effect?
Yeah.
Lots of different hoses.
There's
slew water, there's clouds, there's ocean, there's the water from breath, there's the mist on mountains. Dew. The breath from a newborn baby, the breath from a mass murderer, water. Do you understand? Those propensities will come together where circumstances flow them according to where they can appear and ripen. Now, say that you, with all that seed bag of karma that is a you, for the moment, a temporary you, spend all of your time bringing all of your being into the aspiration to act compassionately for the sake of all beings. That's a pretty powerful hose shape. And the velocity is all the same. And it will shoot to one particular place. And it will probably recreate a similar hose and just carry on. That's called a tulku. Or a Rinpoche. Is that fair? I think it's very fair. You know, get on with it. Seeds of karma ripen. As ye sow, so shall ye reap. And the only thing that is questionable in that is the ye part. As you sow, so shall you reap. If you make you all sentience, then that's true. All sentience as one mass, that just the form keeps changing, but the seeds of karma. The Tibetans also say a being who is born into hell doesn't know it's hell, it's just business as usual to them. They don't know it's hell, it just feels quite normal to them. Because the body born of those propensities fits the desire of that activity.
Right, okay.
The body is shaped according to the motive. And at which part, at which point, what part of yourself is some part that has not known some part of myself? Which point can we separate ourselves from each other if you look at the endless seeds of karma ripening throughout all time and space? All beings, my mother. See, it's a sense of self that we get trapped by. And it's a felt sense, that sense of self. We actually think that there's such a thing as innocence. We don't know that seeds of karma are ripening. And that is not to say that you can just say, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it, that's the karma. No, you can do, repent. Repent. You can do remorse. You can do vow. You can do refuge. You can practice the wholesome. You can create the energy for coming out of ignorance for the sake of all beings. And every moment, every being has that choice. Seeds of karma ripening, maybe people, it's harder for them to see that choice. You find many examples if you read the Buddha's teaching. Straight from the horse's mouth, you find many examples where he is teaching someone and they are very satisfied and they go away. And someone says to the Buddha, "Oh, that was very great teaching. You know, has he awakened?" And he says, the Buddha says, "No, because there are seeds of karma ripening that obscure it, but it will arise." You know, even someone so great as a Sama Sambuddhasa it isn't going to be any guru that waves a magic wand over you. You're the one with the wand. It's not going to happen tomorrow or the next day or when circumstances are right. Today's the best circumstance we have. I'm doing fire and brimstone tonight, aren't I? I don't very often do fire and brimstone, do I? But it's true. This is true. This is very worth looking at. When you're old, well, I'm too old. When you're young, well, I'm too young. When you're middle-aged, well, I'm too busy. You know? There is no time that is not the right time to practice Dharma. Well, when I get my act together, well, when I'm happier, well, when I'm sadder, well, when I'm richer, well, when I'm poorer. Really? That's not a precious human birth then, is it? Because you can't practice Dharma. You're the one who makes it a precious human birth. Don't wait for permission. Give yourself permission. Repent. Remorse. Vow, refuge. That's a pretty easy formula. The three R's and a V.
Seems to me that a sign of success in the practice then is when you become aware of the opportunities to repent. Because
yes.
I have noticed incredibly intense situations since Vajrasattva. One I remember in particular, I saw a fellow a disabled fellow that's at the university. He's done marvelous things, but he's really crippled and in terrible straits in this wheelchair. And this sense of incredible anger hit me like a brick wall when I looked at him. And I'm like, wow, where did that come from?
Exactly.
And then there was someone with a mask on that was sitting in the theater, and they were also in disabled circumstances. And again, there was this incredible sense of intense discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really aware of it. And I thought to myself, you're reacting this way because of the practice. Because in
your awareness is
past
there.
Circumstances, you wouldn't have...
Yeah, it just... would have been just you.
Yeah.
You would have just turned away.
Yeah.
Habitual. Cage is up. That's right. And I tell you, quite honestly, if you have nothing to repent for, you're not paying attention. Or you're too proud. Yeah. Repent does not mean grovel or whip yourself or... You know. It means name the unwholesome. Name it. Name it. Pay attention. Oh, wait, that's unwholesome. Interrupt it with awareness. And you can't do that until you do some practice. You're right, that is a sign of practice. my beloved teacher Namgyal Rinpoche used to say, when you begin to do the practice, you've got a bit of a cold, and after you've done a bit of practice, you've got cancer. You know, when you begin to do it, you just have a few little problems you want to get rid of. But once you start practicing, oh my God, I've got this terminal illness. And that's exactly right. That's a sign of good practice. When you begin to see that this really is true, you know, a lot of the mind is habitually creating the unwholesome circumstances that cause suffering. And it takes a healthy ego to be able to name it. Because an unhealthy ego will just collapse. Oh, pass a drink. Right? Or find somebody else to blame. Well, I was doing really good practice, but then he, she, they. No.
She was cutting out. Thinking of this point of view or discipline, the teaching, where you see the, so to some extent you begin to sense that you are not an unchanging self, that you are coming to into more meaning to happen. But there is something in the teaching that says, this I am not. Something arises in me, like a flash of anger. Instead of being ego to, I couldn't be angry.
Yeah, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself.
But if I come and say that this is interesting,
yeah,
what is it, where does it come from?
Yeah, or even what is it? You don't even have to ask where it comes from. That gets too intellectual. But you say, how does it feel?
Yeah.
And the answer is, rotten. And you say, drop it. I repent of this. Drop it. I repent of this.
Well, I had a difficulty with the heat, and I had some concentration problems with the heat. There was an older man getting on the bus with the metal sticks and the hip out and trying to get on, and he was interrupting me. And I felt a sort of flash of annoyance, and I thought, my God, there am I.
That's right.
And I just thought, I managed to pull towards him some light and kind of help him, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid of his condition.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. That's exactly why we use anger, to get away from something. Mm-hmm. Exactly why we use it. Most of the time. Because we don't want it. Usually fear underneath. Not always, but usually.
Well, I think with older people or crippled people or something, there's a fear in the body. You don't want to see that that's coming. Some form of that is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily wishing it on anyone, but form.
Yeah, form. This is impermanent.
Form is impermanent.
Yeah, and then after that, birth is impermanent too.
Yeah.
You know? Like, start picking out your neighborhood, Morris.
Yeah.
Well, start eyeing those young couples lining up to get married. Do they have any Dharma books? Excuse me, I'd like to see your library. You want to be in the prairies or Ontario this time?
Rama Zaza.
Where do you pick, the prairies or Ontario?
Well, Rama Zaza was asking, could he come back? Do I have a choice? I'd like to go to another planet for a booster shot.
Oh, a booster shot.
I understand that. Another planet or another plane?
Another plane.
Plane, yeah.
For a booster shot.
Yeah, I understand. And you told me that before, and I can appreciate that. The problem that I have, I really would not like to do that myself.
No,
I really wouldn't.
Well, humans are another realm.
I would not want to do that.
You wouldn't.
Thank you. because I feel like I'm so dull, And I'm beginning to understand some things now. And if I took a little holiday, I would get dull again. And for the sake of the many, my many friends, they keep me honest. My friends keep me honest. And I know my addictive personality. What I'd like to do is really go out with a strong sense of vow and refuge. Strong sense of vow and refuge. I'd really like to do that. I've got my, you know, it takes 3 kalpas to become a Sammasambuddhasa. Did you know that?
3 kalpas
from the time you're prophesied. You have to be prophesied by a Buddha. So the Buddha Shakyamuni prophesied the last one, who apparently was what's his name? Asanga is the one, and he's now in training. Maitreya is the one ready to come. He's ripe. He's already hatched. He's just waiting for the right time to drop down from heaven. Okay. Now, Asanga is in training. He's going to be the next one. But the one after him hasn't been picked yet. So that's probably going to be about 9 kalpas. So we have about 9 kalpas to decide whether that's going to be our career choice. Do you understand? So that's not very much time. You consider the seeds of karma ripening.
9 kalpas?
That's a long time.
It sounds like a long time, but it's not so long. Listen, one lifetime, poof.
Yeah, but kalpa is from life, the beginning of a universe to the end of a universe or something like that?
No, a kalpa is 320 million years.
Oh.
It's lovely to be erudite.
Is it the standard
time? Yeah, it's lovely to be erudite. And the world, the destructions occur alternatively. Wind and fire, and then every once in a while there's a great destruction which is by water. I think I got that right. I could have that wrong, but that's how I'm remembering it at the moment. And when a great kalpa occurs, all of the consciousness is moved, you know, goes to higher ground to escape the flood, basically, is in a heaven realm, basically. Then after the worlds start to reform, after a very long period of time, then they start venturing out from that heaven realm and go to other realms, start looking for something else to eat. And then they find things that taste delicious here and there and here and there. One of the myths about the creation of this planet has to do with beings from another realm found that the essence of this planet was so sweet that they used to come and hang out in it and suck of it. And they got heavier and heavier as time went by, and eventually they couldn't escape it. And that's how consciousness began on this planet. This fits in with this teaching. That the universe continuously dissolves and recreates, but the seeds of karma continue, even through kalpas. It's interesting, eh?
Is it possible that it's true in one statement of you keep coming back to the earth? One suggestion is, if you're looking to complete yourself with something from outside of yourself, you haven't reached a sense of union, you won't be looking for completion.
I didn't follow a word of that. Do you mind repeating it?
Well, it was initially called the Spanish reincarnated Rinpoche. The saying that if you can reach a point of intimacy with the universe, you feel you belong.
So do you understand that as being non-cage?
Yeah.
From what I was just saying?
Yeah.
So what self is that? Because the intimacy is totality, not
yeah.
itself. So what is there to want union with?
Well, the being will have a sense of not yet enlightened and needing something for completion.
Why, if there is intimacy?
Well, there isn't any. They haven't had the intimacy.
Oh yeah, that's another way of saying the same thing. You can say that you create a self because you don't feel intimate.
Right.
And you think, you know, you're protecting yourself from the loneliness by creating all these barriers, but the self itself stops the intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, the implication was that you're at some stage, it may not be worth considering now and coming up on it. There was a suggestion that you reach a point in the human experience where you have, where there's intimacy with the universe, you can move on to other.
Well, that would be probably Bodhisattva, which is where Maitreya is. One birth to go to Sammasambuddhasa. Hanging out there in one of the God realms, waiting for the time to be right to drop like a fruit to the ground. There are.
Can he lose it in the God realm?
No. No one who is a bodhisattva, a full bodhisattva, can lose anything. So, but it's a career choice, you know, you have to work your way up to president.
It's interesting to note also that I was reading some articles on this Maitreya, who's supposed to be the future prophesied of the next Buddha.
He's the next Buddha. Yeah.
That there's also in the Christian
prophesied by the Buddha before this Buddha.
Yeah, there's also the mythology of the second coming of Christ, or Christ consciousness. And there's a direct similarity between those two teachings in a lot of ways. I think there's an interesting book out too, I can't remember the name of it, but Rudolf Steiner mentioned one of his books that I was reading called Karma and Reincarnation. It's an old book called The Essential Buddha and Christ. And it's a book that talks about the similarities between the two aspects of two individuals born at separate times, separate traditions, 500 years apart from each other, yet they're both were attained and were sort of speaking the same dialogue in different languages about this.
Well, there are more than that. There was Zoroaster too, was around at the same time, wasn't he? Confucius was a couple of hundred years before the Buddha, but not many. So there was a whole cluster of beings born about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been a hot time in the old town.
I think so.
Who was besides before Shakyamuni Buddha then?
Huh?
Who was before Shakyamuni Buddha?
His name was Dipankara.
Dipankara. Okay.
That was the Buddha before, supposedly.
Supposedly.
Thus
okay.
have I heard.
Okay. Then what's happening then on other planets then? I mean, are they?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Good question.
Yeah. There's according to the seeds of karma ripening. That's what's happening.
Oh, there. Okay.
So this lama was giving
us. Would the Dharma go there though? Would the Dharma give us other planets?
Well, this lama was giving a talk in Calgary, and it was several years ago, and I thought that was very brave because I was born in Calgary, and I think it's very brave for a Tibetan lama to come and teach Dharma in Calgary, because I know I have my fixed views about Calgary, having spent my younger days there. And so I love to go anyway to hear Dharma, but I was really curious about this guy because he was talking about rebirth and things like that, and then he asked for questions. And you got all these rednecks and cowboys in the audience, right? And they're asking questions. And I'm just impressed with this guy that, you know, this really nice Tibetan man is sitting there in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, answering questions from all these cowboys, you know, who just came off branding time. Questions about rebirth, right? And he was beautiful. It was just so beautiful, and it was really good for my fixed views. You know, I got a few good swats on my conceit, real good from that. And then at one point, one of the people said, okay, this is all very interesting, but what I want to know is, you know, you talk about this rebirth stuff, and I have real trouble believing it, because if that's true, how come there's more humans now than there were 1,000 years ago? And he said, well, maybe they heard about the computers and the video games. And he sort of waved his hand, and you could see these planets through the universe behind him. Maybe they heard about, you know, many, many realms. You know, if you've never left town, you don't realize that you probably have left town. What planet? How would you know? You were reborn here. How would you know? You would have to have recall. Is there only one place to come from? Is there only one earth? From a Buddhist point of view, no. No, 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 no. Many realms.
But okay, what I'm saying though, asking though, within, there's this realm here, but can you practice, is the Dharma practice, are we practicing in other realms, though? Like,
you mean in God realms, things like that?
Let's say, well, other physical realms like Earth. I mean, presume that there are other physical
realms. Yeah, where
like Earth.
The rules apply.
Yeah, that there'd be the Dharma there too.
A law is a law.
Pardon?
A law is a law.
Well, okay, yeah.
Not special cases. You don't have only one planet in the entire universe that has people. From a Buddhist point of view, you don't have that. That would, you know, you don't have something arising in some little special case here. Mm. Or one son of God, or, you know. Mm-hmm. Which makes Buddhism a little difficult for some people. A big difficult, because it's nice to believe that there's some supernatural force that's going to save you. It's really hard to think that you have to be the one in charge of repent, remorse.
I believe.
You really like that magic wand, you know, some god that's going to, if you just do it right, you really like your rules.
Give me some stable data.
And I like my rules too, you know. But I don't like the idea that some people are saved and some people aren't. I don't like that idea. Because it doesn't seem to be true to me. I have not seen that. That has not been my experience. This week a friend, next week an enemy, next week a friend. But always seeds of karma ripening. More or less ignorance. Causes and conditions, but no fixed self. How's that? Is that enough? Is that warm enough now? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Is the practice of Vajrasattva one of the best antidotes to that state where the repent and remorse becomes sort of overwhelming sometimes?
Yeah, yes. Anything that you want to change a pattern, Vajrasattva is it. Is it. It is a profoundly beautiful practice. And there are different ways to work with it. I auto did tapes of the teaching, and I think it's possible to hear them if that's useful to you. It is one of the four foundations for a very good reason. First you do prostrations, then you do Vajrasattva. Do them together. He is a great teacher, Vajrasattva. He's a great teacher. He's dependable. Nandro Rinpoche said to me one time, very rare this ever happens, he said to me, "So what meditation are you doing?" Quickly, I answered. Vajrasattva. Felt slightly embarrassed because it's some years into studying with him. And I said, "I just felt like I should go back and do more of it." And he said, that's good. You can never do too much Ching Rei Si, and you can never do too much Vajrasattva. It's a profound practice. It will shorten the work. Increase the joy. And you're allowed to shamelessly ask for what you want, which is always nice too. Any other questions, answers, comments, complaints?
Well, the first two, is that the same as like repenting and the remorse? There's also, mm-hmm. you come across sort of like renunciation. Is that the same as all of it? Is that different?
There are some similar qualities, but for me, renunciation comes from realizing that something is not going to satisfy you.
Yeah.
So that you give it up. It's like you eat a really good meal, mm-hmm. and then you say, "That was lovely, but there is something else that I'm hungry for, mm-hmm. so I'm not going to stuff myself on food yeah. anymore. I'm going to look for something that will satisfy another hunger."
Right.
That to me is renunciation.
Okay.
You can't renounce what you haven't tried. If you haven't tried something, you're renouncing it. You're not renouncing it, you're avoiding it.
But
generally speaking, I'm not talking about things like murder, bank robbery, you know, bombing, you know, kindergartens or things like that. You know, I'm not getting it to that level. But you understand what I'm saying. From a moral point of view.
Sure.
Well, Gurdjieff said it probably a lot more clearly. He said that true morality comes from experience. You know what you want to do because you know what happens if you don't do it. You know? And a lot of us in this room should have some morality. A lot of us in this room, shouldn't we? Some true morality, not just a bunch of judgments, right? Because we've done enough of those things, haven't we? I mean, we tasted that fruit of fruit, wouldn't you say? That we should have a sense of humor about what it is we're not going to do. We don't have to be grim about our rules. You know, we look at somebody getting stoned and you can say, they offer you a toke, you say, "Oh, no thanks." Oh, what an interesting idea, but no. It's very easy, it's very simple. You don't need a soapbox, that's renunciation. Say, "No, I don't think so." Thanks all the same, I'm going that way. And that's a kind of morality that's very trustworthy because you don't get exhausted carrying it around. It's very clear to you, you know. That was Gurdjieff said that, you know. Mm-hmm. True morality comes from experience. You can make rules, but that's not true morality. That's useful if you're really confused and got a lot of anger. Make rules. But at some point or other, you have to trust yourself enough to not make rules, but choose the wholesome. Because you prefer it. So that's renunciation.
Okay.
Renunciation shouldn't be so much work. You're renouncing this because...
you see something better.
Yeah. You got your eyes on the prize.
Okay.
Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Just want to tell everybody that you'll be feeding the puja on
Sunday. We'll do the puja Sunday, 10:30. Cheng Wei Zi. Da, 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 da. So you feel this beautiful light in your heart, it moves through your body, this gold light, down your arms and legs, through your head. Moves out in all directions, washes the entire world, the entire universe, just shoots out everywhere. So that any unwholesomeness due to ignorance of body, speech, and mind is just temporarily assuaged, and you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there's less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.